see if there are any questions from what we talked about yesterday in terms of evidence for dark matter or what the agenda for the class is. Yes?
When you said that you can see the sound waves in the CMB spectrum, what do you mean by that? You can see that there are sound waves, or?
Yeah, so the sound waves result in some local regions of compression and rarefaction, which give you hotter and colder spots. And so what you can do is you can look for departures from sort of the smoothness of the CMB. You can look for a little like hot and cold fluctuations. Yeah. And right, okay. And so because of these oscillations, there are going to be correlations associated with the two spots on the sky that are both hot at the same time because they're oscillating in phase, essentially. So I didn't want to get into it because they talk about this more in the cosmology class, but basically what inflation does for you is it sort of resets all of your oscillation modes associated with gravitational perturbations. And so as things re-enter the horizon, they start oscillating and everything oscillates in phase. And so you get this these bumps, the wiggles that look like so these are associated with the physical size of things entering the horizon. And so everything that enters the horizon and is oscillating in phase and it hits a maximum there contributes to sort of some characteristic scale, angular scale.
Everything was the same size to begin with. If all the perturbations that we're talking about were the same.
Well, so you expect that inflation generates a scale invariant spectrum, and so you can actually, you actually do this for all the modes, and you do the computation. You still find that they give you this contribution. So, but basically, what these wiggles are the oscillations associated with the baryon photon fluid. So, the actual derivation of it is somewhat involved. So I don't want to go through that, but. If you did not have, say, inflation where everything, it was resetting the mode so that they were all oscillating at the same time. So basically the time derivative is zero as they're re-entering the horizon. So they're all like cosine modes instead of sine Fourier modes. If you didn't have that, then it would just be a jumble. Everything would cancel each other out and you wouldn't see this kind of peak structure. So this is a very strong indicator that inflation is something that happened. And it also allows us to extract all the properties, fortunately, of the relative composition of the universe at that time. We can talk more about it later if you want to. Any other questions? Okay. So today what we're going to be looking at is now that we believe that there's dark matter and we want to come up with some explanation for what it is, we want to be able to come from some theory input, so a Lagrangian, some kind of spectrum of particles, a bunch of things that I specify their interactions and charges. And then I want to be able to compute how much of it is left today. And if I want this thing to be dark matter, then it's this omega whatever this is should be the dark matter component. Remembering that this omega is sort of the fraction of the energy of the universe that's included in whatever species my dark matter is. And so in order to understand this, there are two things that we need to know. Things we need. We need to know the conditions in the early universe. So we need to know, in order for this statement to even really make sense, that something was created in the early universe and there's something left over, we need to know what was going on. So this is things like characteristic energy scales of interactions, densities of particles, etc. So this tells me roughly what was going on sort of as a whole in the universe at early times. And then I also need to know the rates of particle production, scattering, annihilation. All of these things are actually related to one another through crossing symmetry. For our new theory, so I'm putting in some new particles and some interactions. I can compute various rates associated with this, and then I plug in the conditions. So what the universe looked like, which together with sort of characteristic cross-sections, this tells us how many particles there were and how those numbers of particles evolved as the universe evolved. And what's nice about this is that this is something that, in principle, we know how to do, and you should know how to do. This you should have learned in your quantum field theory classes, where you took, say, a standard model Lagrangian or some toy model, and given some couplings and some different interactions, you would have calculated scattering rates. And these cross sections would have been functions of, say, the input energies and the flux rates. You know, if it's you're at the LHC, you know, how many protons are you firing at one another, and so on and so on. So this is something that we know how to do. So what we really need to figure out is what's going on in the early universe and then how we can interface these things together. So what are the clues that we have about the early universe? So if I want to be fairly ignorant and not think, not sort of know that I've already taken GR and that I have some idea of what the universe looked like at early times, we can use the fact that there is this cosmic microwave background. It's some collection of photons. It's about 2.7 Kelvin. And it has a density of about 400 photons per centimeter cubed. So these are just things that I can see right now. I turn on a telescope, I just count the number of photons that are hitting me. And I can see what they're characteristic frequency spectrum looks like, and so that tells me what the temperature is. So this tells me that there is a lot of stuff in the universe, but that it's quite cold, and that that's dense, but for something like photons for radiation, it's not too dense. And I take that and I add in the fact that we observe the universe expanding. And I say, well, okay, so the universe is expanding. This tends to dilute densities. It makes things colder. I can just do the exact same thing and rewind it. I can say, okay, well, if I undo the Hubble expansion and go to earlier times, then this collection of photons is going to get hotter, and the length scales are going to shrink, and so I'm going to end up with more per centimeter cubed. So what we end up with is the suggestion that the universe was hot and dense. Okay, and so the best way to describe something that is hot and dense is through thermodynamics. So what we need are the, all the thermodynamic relationships in the expanding universe, and we're going to use what's now the CMB, but it was always the photon bath, what we'll call it, as sort of a benchmark. This is going to be a combination of our clock. It's going to tell us what the sort of characteristic properties of the universe were at a particular point in time. And then we can use that information to compute all of these things related to particle physics processes. So what we're going to do today is first review the Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe, because this is the general way of describing a homogeneous and isotropic universe. And this is really driving the dynamics of the Hubble expansion. Then we'll talk about what it means for equilibrium thermodynamics in this background, and then what happens when you start moving away from that equilibrium setup. Okay. So are there any questions about what we're hoping to do? Yes.
So when you say the CMB as a benchmark, sorry, the photon bath as a benchmark, that means that there's a possibility that different temperatures at the same time.
That's right. That's right. So we'll get into that when I start defining equilibrium thermodynamics more specifically. But it's helpful to define like a temperature, which will be the temperature of the photons, and use that to determine various things. But yeah, and I actually think in the tutorial they'll work on a problem that has different temperatures. Okay, so let's get started. So I know that most, or hopefully all of you, have taken some class in GR and in cosmology, so I'm not going to go through the details. I'm just going to remind you of the key things that are going to be important for us. So what we want to do is we make various assumptions about what the universe looked like just so that we make the problem more tractable. So we assume homogeneity, that the universe is the same everywhere. and isotropy, that it looks the same everywhere in any direction that we look in. And these are well-motivated assumptions from, for instance, our current measurement of the CMB, where we do see that it's isotropic to a very high degree. Which and there are these fluctuations that suggest that there's some non-homogeneity in the universe, but these are at like the 1 part in 10 to the 5 level. So very, very small corrections. So we expect this to be reasonable. And we can use these symmetries to just write down the most general form of my metric. So that is going to be dt squared minus a of t squared times a spatial metric. And there are various ways you can write it. It has a 2 on it. And so basically what this is this is what we call the scale factor. And it's a function of the time coordinate only. And it's making all of your spatial distances bigger as you go to later times. And so this is going to be the thing that's telling us that the universe is expanding. It's the A of t is getting bigger. And then this is just the shape of the space part of your space-time. Space part. Okay? And what we see here is that even if the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, it's possible that it's curved. Now, measurements of the CMB, among other things, actually tell us that the curvature is very close to zero. So we know this to about 0.1% or so. So for the purposes of the rest of this class, we're just going to assume that the curvature is zero. And so then this is just your simple Minkowski metric, flat space. So the only non-trivial thing that's going on in the FRW universe that's flat is that there's this scale factor that, as time evolves, changes how you measure distances. And throughout, I should say, we use what are called natural units, where we set h bar and the speed of light to 1. So this means that, for instance, the units of energy have the same thing as the units of inverse length, which is the same units of inverse time. You can convert between these things by multiplying and dividing by h bar and c, which are just 1. Okay, so the properties of this universe are set entirely by the scale factor. So this is the ruler length at time t. And we also want to know how this ruler length is changing. If a of t was just a constant, then we could just redefine what we call distances, and we could remove it from our problem entirely. And the change of this scale is called the Hubble scale. And the Hubble scale is defined as the time derivative of the scale factor over the scale factor. Okay, and the Hubble scale is basically related to the time it takes to double the size of the universe. Specifically for a flat universe, so if k is equal to 0, then h is inversely proportional to time. So we see that a large h is a short doubling time, which makes sense because it means that our scale factor is changing very quickly relative to the size. Similarly, a small h corresponds to a large doubling time. And so this provides us some way of determining how time scales in our problem relate to the time scale of the expansion of the universe. Okay, so this is fine, but we actually want to be able to know what is A of t, and how are other scale things like the temperature of our bath or other things, how are they related to t? So to do this, we actually have to solve for the dynamics of the system. And in GR, we do this using Einstein's equations. And what Einstein's equations tell us is that there's a relationship between the energy, momentum in a system, and the space-time dynamics. So if I have a lot of energy, it tends to be a curved space. If that's changing a lot, it drives dynamics a lot. And if it's small, then my dynamics are relatively stable. Okay? So the only non-trivial thing that's going on in this metric is the scale factor A. And so the space-time dynamics are entirely encoded in the Hubble scale, or alternately in the scale factor. So when we solve the Einstein equations, we're going to have some relationship between the Hubble scale, which is measuring the sort of physical size of my universe, and the energy content of the universe. Okay, so what's this? We don't know, but in GR, this is described by the energy momentum tensor. And even if I don't know in advance what is in the energy momentum tensor, I can use the fact that I assumed homogeneity and isotropy to write down the most general energy momentum tensor that is consistent with these symmetries. If I didn't do that, then if I put in some inhomogeneous energy momentum tensor, it would result in an inhomogeneous metric, which would totally invalidate the whole thing. So if this has any hope of being right, you make these assumptions, you require them to be self-consistent, and then you see what the answer gives you. Okay? And it turns out that this is actually a reasonable thing. It gives you predictions that match what we observe astrophysically. Okay, so this is going to be given by a 4x4 metric. These are my space-time indices. So the homogeneity and isotropy actually require this to be a diagonal matrix where the entries can be a row and then three entries along the diagonal that are minus p, and then everything else zero. Okay. So the fact that these three things are the same is related to, more specifically, to the homogeneity and isotropy. Okay. And there's sort of a special distinction between space and time in this picture. Just like in this metric, there's a distinction that's going on between the spatial part of your metric and the time part. Okay. And basically, different kinds of matter, so whether something is relativistic or non-relativistic, is going to be encoded in the relationship between p and rho. So we call this the equation of state. And it relates this p to rho. And if we think a little bit about what's going on, p seems to be some energy that's associated with spatial movement, whereas rho is the energy of something that's just sitting, like its entire energy. So this is referred to as the energy density. And right now, these are just parameters, but you can show that they match on to the same kinds of physical parameters that you would expect. So this energy density is actually the energy that you would think of in normal, you know, particle physics associated with a bunch of particles. And then this is the pressure of a gas. Okay, so this is related to how quickly things are moving and how, what that does to drive the expansion. And so we can look at a few different scenarios. And again, I'm just going to state these. Hopefully you cover them in your cosmology class, or you can look them up. But they seem like pretty reasonable choices. And as you can see, they give you answers that look like what you'd expect that kind of matter to look like. So we'll start with relativistic matter. Okay, this we're generally going to refer to as radiation, no matter what it is. So it could actually be a heavy particle, but as long as it's relativistic, its energy is dominated by its momentum rather than its mass. And so it's typically going to have a large pressure. Okay? And because there are 3 degrees of freedom that can be moving in, the pressure is a third of rho. This is something that you can drive just in normal electromagnetism, and anytime you have some massless particle bouncing off of walls, you get pressure as a third of energy density. Okay. The second thing that we're going to care about is what we're going to call, well, it's non-relativistic matter. And this is what we're going to refer to as matter, somewhat confusingly, but when I say matter here, I really mean sort of matter that we can describe by quantum field theory. when I talk about matter in a cosmological sense, what I really mean is stuff that's moving slowly relative to its mass. So since it's moving slowly, it doesn't really have any pressure at all. So this is the W equals zero case. And then the third possible thing is vacuum energy. And then this is often referred to as dark energy, or cosmological constant. And this corresponds to a pressure of minus rho. This is basically just if you have some diagonal thing that has all entries, then you have some inherent energy associated with space-time. And that's basically what a cosmological constant is. And not coincidentally, these are the three kinds of things that we find in our universe. So these are the three things that we actually care about what they are and how they contribute to this energy momentum tensor in turn tells you how it drives the space-time dynamics. So the expansion of the universe is going to be linked to whether you have mostly radiation, matter, or dark energy, because that's going to be telling you what the differential equation for A is satisfying. Okay, are there any questions about this so far? Okay. So we can now take our Einstein equations, which I'm not going to write out in their full component, but they simplify greatly because we really only have like three parameters in our theory. We have the scale factor, we have rho, and we have p. So we have something that looks like this. Sorry, there's a g here. And so there are two independent equations. One is it relates the Hubble scale to the total energy density. Kind of not block it. And then the second one, so this basically determines the first derivative of the scale factor. This is proportional to a dot over a squared. And then there's also a term that's a second derivative, which is a double dot over a. Gives you something that's proportional to the energy density plus three times the pressure. Okay, the precise form of these equations is not very important. You probably solved them at some point. What's just relevant is that they tell us that what's going on in the energy momentum tensor tells us what's happening in the scale factor. Now, there's actually, in this equation, there's typically also a term that goes like minus the curvature over a squared. Now, we've set the curvature to zero, but technically the curvature is only zero if the left and right-handed sides of the equation balance out. Okay. So what we do is we define something that's called rho critical, which is 3h squared over 8 pi g, and if k is equal to zero, then rho critical, then rho total is equal to rho critical. So you can see that if I just plug in rho critical here, then this equation is trivially satisfied. Okay. So the fact that the curvature is zero tells you that there's some relationship between the sum of the different densities of your components and this density that's determined by the Hubble scale. Okay. And if you look at it from this perspective, it seems really weird that we have a flat universe because you basically need to tune the amounts of matter that you have in order to exactly satisfy this equation. But with inflation tells us that maybe the universe actually wasn't curved, but then there was this period of very rapid expansion that removed any curvature. And so that explains why we don't actually see any curvature. But this is a handy benchmark because if we normalize all of our densities to this rho critical, then this tells us like basically the fraction that's in each abundance. So we define these quantities omega I, which is rho I over 3h squared over 8 pi g, or basically rho I over rho critical. So then k equals 0 tells us that the sum of the omega I's is 1. And we'll just call this, so this is basically your omega total, but because it's one, we usually just drop it. Okay, so these equations tell us everything that we need to know to relate the matter content to the space-time expansion. Yes.
So p equals zero for both dark matter and baryonic matter, right? That's right. So was there a time when the universe was hot and dense, but it was more dense than hot, and p was not zero for baryonic matter because of like Fermi degeneracy pressure or whatever it's called? Like, in other words, was there a time when baryonic matter was not radiation, but it was dense enough where p was small but not zero?
No. Typically, the densities at finite temperature are not high enough to go into the quantum statistics limit unless the temperature is really high.
Okay.
So, yeah. But that's an interesting point. I haven't really thought about that. But so usually, if you just compute, like, we'll say today what the abundances are, and you can just compute what the contributions are to the you know.
Well, they're tiny right now, but were they always tiny?
They were, yeah. So you can basically solve it under the assumption of like Boltzmann statistics and then sub back in and see what the corrections are, and they're small. So usually when we're computing like things like scattering rates, we can ignore things like Fermi, Pauli blocking or whatever. I suppose that you could have some weird thermal history where you were in some phase where there was some local very dense region or something, but that doesn't really happen, at least in our universe. But yeah, it'd be very interesting to think about what happens in that case. Okay. In the context of our universe, what we now call matter was just something that we called radiation at some earlier time, basically. Okay, so now that we have this, we can assume some composition of our universe, some relative quantities of matter, radiation, and dark energy. We can sub them into these equations, and we can just solve for how the universe expands. And we find that the energy densities change with time differently depending on what they are. So the type of stuff changes with A differently. And this you can find just by solving the first of the Friedman equations. Sorry, the second of the Friedman equations that I wrote on the board. So in particular, if you solve it, you find that the radiation energy density scales like A of t to the minus 4. The matter density scales like A to the minus 3. And the vacuum energy is a constant with respect to A. So we can understand this if we think a little bit more about, you know, what does it mean for something to be radiation. Radiation means that most of its energy is in kinetic energy. We know that such things are well described by waves, that there's some associated wavelength, say, for light or for whatever it is that we're looking at. And so the effects of changing A, there's going to be a volume factor change of A to the minus 3. That just comes from this metric here where all of my length scales are changing by A. And so if I start with some box and then the box expands, then the number of particles is the same after the expansion in three dimensions. And so my spatial density scales like A to the minus 3. But because this is a wave and has some characteristic wavelength, this also gets stretched by the expansion. So this is the cosmological redshift. And we know that energy is inversely proportional to wavelength. And so this gives you an extra factor, suppression of energy for radiation. So we see that radiation scales like A to the minus 3 because the density, your things are being diluted because space is getting bigger, and then the wavelength is also being stretched, which gives you an extra factor. Right? Now, for matter, it's dominated by its mass energy, and so the wavelength is not really what's determining its energy. Okay? So the only thing that's important for something that's non-relativistic is just counting up how many they are and multiplying by their mass to get their energy. So if my space is expanding, then their number density is diluting by A to the minus 3, but I don't have an additional suppression associated with the redshift. Right? And then finally, if you have a vacuum energy, you can just solve and show that this doesn't actually change. And the reason is that if I put p equal to minus rho, I end up with some energy density that's just proportional to the flat space metric. So there's some energy that's inherent to space-time. So if I double my amount of space-time, I'm doubling my amount of energy because my energy density is just the same. Okay. So what this tells us is that if I start out with some universe that was a mixture of, you know, at t zero, that was a mixture of radiation plus matter plus the vacuum energy, then this thing goes like a to the minus 4, this thing goes like a to the minus 3, and this one is constant. So as my universe expands, what happens is slowly the amount of energy and radiation drops below the amount of energy and matter, and the amount of matter drops below the amount of energy in the vacuum. Okay? And that this is the universe that we find ourselves in now, where actually have there's more dark energy than there is anything else. Okay? And as the universe continues to expand, we will find ourselves even more in that situation because these number densities are slowly being diluted. Okay, so we are here now in a vacuum-dominated universe. But if I take that logic and apply it backwards, then everything goes up by however much I'm shrinking the universe. And so I eventually find myself back in an era of radiation dominance, okay? Just because the shrinking space as I go backwards in time gives me an enhancement of the density and also an enhancement from the wavelength. Also, just things were more relativistic when they were moving around earlier. So I'll just state this as a fact that for the times we care about, the universe was radiation dominated. So what we're going to do is just take the approach of assuming that it's radiation dominated, and then we will double check that it is radiation dominated when we actually figure out, you know, how much there is of everything. If you want to be really careful, you would keep everything the most general form and then, you know, figure out what it is. But of course, integrating these equations is complicated if you have lots of different components, but it's generally quite easy if you only have one component or one component that's driving the expansion. So we're just going to take those up. That is an ansatz and solve for all of our relations. Okay.
Question?
Yes.
So this is kind of probably silly. So the way that you derived how the different densities depended on scale factor was by plugging in the equation of state in the second the Friedman equation.
That's right.
And then, but you know, the universe is kind of a sum of all these different kinds of things, right? So I guess. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, Einstein's equations are not really linear.
Mm-hmm.
So do I have to worry about that here? That
so Einstein's equations, you're right that these equations aren't linear, right? And people do solve them in more generality, but because of these different changing profiles with A, what you find is that what is a good approximation to the solution is basically assuming a radiation-dominated universe, and then at the boundary where there's a crossover, you do a matching calculation onto a matter-dominated universe, and that gives you a reasonable approximation. Because for the times that you're integrating over, there's typically only one effort that's driving the whole expansion. But you're right that that this is sort of a fudge that we're doing. And what you find in cosmology is that it's almost impossible to solve all of these things in complete generality and keep following them. So what we're always going to do is make certain assumptions, and then we'll see whether those assumptions work or not. So, yeah. But it's a good question. Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Okay. So because we care about a radiation-dominated universe, I'll just quote some simple results for this. So we find in a radiation-dominated universe is that the scale factor scales like, I should say proportional to, the square root of time. Okay. And the Hubble scale, which is 1 over 2 times time, is proportional to a to the minus 2. Okay. So these are very useful things. They basically tell us that if I only have radiation, or that's the thing that's driving my expansion, then my distances are all getting bigger by the square root of time. Okay? And that just comes from solving this equation. And this is something that we're going to use over and over again, okay, in relating times to scale factor. Yes? Okay. So are there any questions about the FRW universe and the different components we've been talking about? No. Okay. So we now want to see, we're going to take this universe as our background, and so what happens when we start considering like the dynamics of the particles that are making up these energy densities? So up until now, we've only been treating this energy as relevant for driving the expansion of the universe. But of course, this is made up of particles, and we know the particles interact with each other. So what happens there? So we're going to be at high density, so there's no way that we're going to be able to figure out what's going on with each individual kind of particle. So we're going to use StatMech in order to determine the average properties of the different particles at a particular point in time. And now one thing that you could be wondering this is that statistical mechanics involves some sense of equilibrium, okay, where I have a system of particles or different configurations, and there are interactions that are allowed between them and, say, heat bath, and it's going to drive the system towards some maximum entropy state. So there's some implicit sense of implicit definition of equilibrium. But we see that in the early universe, there's never really true equilibrium, because equilibrium implies that forward and backward rates are the same, that nothing is changing with time, no change with time. But I just spent about half an hour convincing you that the universe was changing with time, and we were computing how the universe was changing with time and how it was responding to everything. So there seems to be some implicit or some inherent contradiction in this setup, just from the fact that there's an error of time associated with the universe's expansion. So Hubble expansion always violates equilibrium. Now, fortunately for us, the Hubble expansion over much of the universe's time was quite slow relative to some other rates. And so what you can do is you can define a quasi-steady state evolution. So what I do is at a particular time t, I treat the background as fixed. I figure out what my equilibrium configuration is there. And if I assume that the expansion is very slow relative to everything else, then I'll relax into that equilibrium state eventually. So what we want are we consider a time scales that are long compared to reactions, say, between particles or other time scales in my theory, and too short compared to the Hubble time. And so this allows me to define some temporary equilibrium, and that's going to be what the system is trying to relax into. But it rests very much on the assumption that that I can have this hierarchy of time scales that are long compared to reactions going on in my thermal bath, but short compared to the expansion. Okay. So with that in mind, we will assume that this is a reasonable assumption, and it turns out to be. And so the correct system to use is the grand canonical ensemble. And in the grand canonical ensemble, you have some phase space density function, the function of p, the function of x, the function of t. And this t is changing very slowly. Okay, this only comes in from the scale factor. And so you basically just have dependence on your normal phase space variables And this allows you to do statistical mechanics like you always do. Now, it's inconsistent to consider the full dependence on momentum and position because we've already assumed that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic. So it should be invariant under changes in the spatial coordinate, and it should be invariant under looking at different distances. So what you end up with is an equilibrium distribution that looks like this. So this is the grand canonical ensemble. I should say what this is depending on. Okay, and then this minus sign is for bosons. This plus sign is for fermions. And this tells me how various parts of my phase space are populated. And this energy is going to depend on whatever system I'm looking at. Okay. So, yes. Good call. Okay, and then, of course, in the limit where this factor is not important, you just reproduce Boltzmann statistics. Okay, so for a species I, should be careful with my labels, Ti characterizes the energy of whatever object I is. And this mu I is the chemical potential, which characterizes the number of the species I. Right? And so depending on, so if I just tell you I have this collection of particles or a collection of a system, and you go and measure the energy, then this tells you what the T is, because the energy is related to integrals of this distribution over the phase space. Okay? Now there's some subtlety associated with the number of species. Okay? So that's normally what we associate the chemical potential with, is you have some small system and then you have a thermal bath. And that's associated with the exchange of particles across the interface. And the chemical potential drives that to happen. Now, we know in relativity and in quantum field theory that particle number changing reactions are usually fast. Right? This is just a consequence of E equals mc squared. If I have some energy above the mass, then I'm going to very quickly be changing my particle number. So this chemical potential doesn't really refer to the number of particles, because that's not a very well-defined quality, a quantity. It's something that's rapidly changing. And so as you'll show in your tutorial, this chemical potential actually corresponds to the number of some species I minus the number of the anti-species I. Okay? So this corresponds to a matter-antimatter asymmetry. The reason being that most interactions respect this symmetry, and so you actually have, for finite periods of time, some in the early universe, some differences between matter and antimatter, and so that is characterized by this mu. Okay. And we'll talk more about this later. So now that we have our distribution, we can define the particle density. This is just the total integral over the distribution. And this is a function of energy. And we know that for particles, implicitly, energy is a function of momentum, because E is equal to pi squared mi squared. So this is some function of p. So what we do is we say the number of states is the degeneracy of the state, so the number of possible configurations. So for elementary particles, this is usually the number of possible spin states. And then we just do the integral over this phase space distribution. D3P. FIP, where I'm subbing in P here, and energy is a function of P. Okay. Okay, So this is a very important result. Similarly, if I know what the number density is, I can get the energy density by just taking the energy of each particle associated with this distribution and integrating over that. So again, rho I is d3p over 2 pi cubed. B of P, F I of P. Okay. And these are things which I'm just going to tell you what various limits of these are, but they're going to depend on the temperature and the chemical potential and things like this. Okay. So what this tells us is if there's some characteristic energy of the system, that defines a temperature, and then you can use that to determine how many particles you expect and what the energy density of that is. And then this energy density, in turn, goes into all of this stuff and tells you how the universe expands. Okay. So are there any questions about the quantities that we've been defining so far? OK, so a few things that we're going to assume. We're going to assume for most of the class that the chemical potential is small. This is because the universe is mostly matter-antimatter symmetric. It turns out that mu over T is about 10 to the minus 10 at early times, and so we can safely neglect it. But we'll show this to be consistent later. So if we assume this to be true, then I can do these integrals in various limits. And what I end up with is my number density is a function of T. It's going to depend on whether it's relativistic or non-relativistic. So if it's relativistic, I get some prefactor, Vi, so this is if T is much bigger than the mass. Okay? So the number density just scales like the temperature cubed times some prefactor, where the top is a boson and the bottom is a fermion. What is what? Oh, sorry, this is just a zeta function.
No. I mean, the tree factor.
Hmm?
Oh, I understand.
Sorry, so yeah, because we have a plus and a minus sign here. So depending on if I got a plus or a minus, it's going to change what my coefficient is. In the non-relativistic limit, it turns out not to matter. And I get something that looks like this. Over T. Okay. So what I find is that when things are radiation, they just scale like the temperature cubed. And when they're non-relativistic, then what I end up with is this exponential suppression. So this is the usual Boltzmann suppression that you get, where this is just telling you that the characteristic energy of the system is much less than the energy that you need for in a single particle. And so you're exponentially less likely to have this flying around than you are to have radiation. Okay. Okay. So these are how the number density scale of temperature. We can now use this to compute the energy density and then use that to determine how the scale factor depends on temperature. So technically, we have these different temperatures associated with each species. And depending on whether the species talk to each other, they're either going to come into equilibrium or not. So what we're going to do just for convenience is define the photon temperature as the temperature. So if I write down T, I really mean T photon. There could be other things that have different temperatures, but I'm always going to give them as reference to some sort of fundamental temperature. And the reason for this is just that there are always photons around, and so there's some convenient way of measuring what temperature is. OK, so if I take my definition of rho, I can do the integrals in similar limits. And so what I find for radiation-dominated universe is rho is equal to pi squared over 30 d star t to the fourth. where this G star is basically just counting up the number of relativistic particles. So this is for bosons. This is for fermions. So I'm doing this integral for all the different temperatures, and then I'm normalizing them all to this photon temperature. And this is for relativistic species. And because we're radiation dominated, we're assuming that the total energy is well characterized by just taking the energy density of each relativistic species and just adding them up. And you get this very simple form where the energy density scales like temperature to the fourth. Okay. So we know that rho goes like a to the minus fourth for radiation. That's just up there. We know that rho goes like g star t to the fourth. So we now know that if g star is constant, basically there you don't change the number of relativistic species. Then you find these relationships. A is proportional to temperature. Okay. And minus one, and the Hubble scale scales like the temperature squared. Yes.
G star is constant. Explicitly, G star is not something that. It's only constant when all the TIs are the same,
So G star is constant if you don't change the number of relativistic species. The reason is that these temperatures, so if you assume that the temperatures relative to one another remain fixed, then this temperature scales like A to the minus one, this temperature scales like A to the minus one, and they cancel, okay? So really what changes this picture are if, let's say I have a species that was relativistic, and then the characteristic energy hits its mass and it becomes non-relativistic, then you sort of remove it from the energy sum. Then this relationship doesn't quite hold, okay? But for most of the universe's evolution, this was true, and so we see that there's a very direct connection between the temperature of the universe and the time variables, the Hubble scale, scale factor, all the things that are determining the expansion of the universe.
Newton's constant, right?
Yeah, so we're assuming here that G is equal to 1 over m pi squared, I think. Possibly times a factor of 8 pi. I think we're using the reduced Planck mass, which is. Okay. This is good because everything kind of makes sense, where the temperature sort of tells us what the characteristic energy scale is. The energy scale is like t to the fourth. We want this energy to scale like a to the minus fourth, according to the argument. So everything that we've done is self-consistent. Okay. And then the last thing that we want to see is that these expressions So I think it gets to something that Tibber asked, but if I have some number of particles, okay, which is a function of time, then there are two effects associated with evolution. There's the dilution associated with expansion, and then there are thermodynamic processes. So for instance, if we look at the number density of a non-relativistic species, it has this exponential scaling. But again, that's sort of the sum of these two different processes, where the number density is changing from dilution, and the number density is also changing just because energy is larger than the temperature, and so reactions tend to deplete its number density. And so what we want to find um, is something that removes the expansion effects. Because ultimately, everything in the universe is diluting at the same rate. Okay? If I have the room full of stuff and then the room doubles in size, the density of everything drops by half. And usually we care about like the relative numbers of things. The CMB tells us about the relative numbers of baryons to photons, or the relative amount of dark energy to matter, to radiation. And so this stuff really complicates the way we understand the expansion of the universe, because there's sort of lots of different things that are going on at the same time. So what we want to do is find a quantity that's constant as the universe expands, and then express everything relative to that. So what's constant? So if I assume that I'm in thermodynamic equilibrium, then I know that entropy is conserved, right? That's the definition of entropy is that the definition of thermodynamic equilibrium is that you're in the maximal entropy state. So what I assume, and you can show that if you use these equilibrium expressions that entropy is indeed conserved, that you have a conserved entropy from the universe's expansion. There are other processes that can contribute to entropy, but the expansion of the universe is adiabatic because it's slow compared to everything else. If it weren't slow, then my whole equilibrium picture goes out the window. Okay. So what I do is I have the entropy S, and then I define my entropy density, which is the total entropy divided by the scale factor cubed. So this is just saying if I have some box, how much entropy is in that box? Well, as the box doubles in size, my entropy, well, I'm bad at drawing in 3D, but my entropy that was in here is now a factor of an eighth, say, smaller than it was before. And so this is proportional to eta minus 3 always, assuming adiabatic evolution, but that's generally a good assumption. So unlike this expression, where A, going like the temperature, had to assume certain things about the number of relativistic species, this, the only assumption that you have is that the expansion is adiabatic. And what this allows us to do is to define some quantity which is the number density divided by the entropy density. And so the part of the number density that just comes from the dilution gets factored out. So we're basically saying, instead of taking this box and doubling it in size, we're going to take this box and we're going to follow the contents as it's expanding. So that if I look at this quantity, it's constant just under the effects of expansion. Okay? And this is called the yields. And it's constant under expansion. So unlike these n's, where the expansion goes like t and your number density goes like t cubed if it's relativistic and like an exponential, if we divide by this thing, then we're removing the effects of the expansion and we're literally just figuring out how much particular number changes. And this is what we care about for, say, determining the amount of dark matter relative to the amount of baryons, because all of these things are scaling like the expansion, so if I compute the relative yields, then I can just ignore the effect of expansion.
Why do we need to get entropy involved in the first place? Why can't we just have the 1 over volume? Or something else that's just 1 over a cubed? Why do we need to get entropy involved?
So I think, so I mean, effectively, what you're doing is you're always dividing by a cubed. I think that it's just instead of writing a cubed, you can write an s, and it saves you some time. But it's essentially you're using this property of it that it's scaling like the volume.
But you're adding an assumption that, like,
that's right. And so I think that the point is that this is true almost always, and so making this assumption is good. And when it's violated, it's really easy to just account for it.
Okay.
So it's more just a matter of convenience than anything else, I would say. Yes.
Is S something we can measure?
Yes. So I'm now just going to write down the formulas, the last thing that we do. Can measure S. Well, yeah, that's a good point. So it is true that there that you can associate a number with S. I mean, I still think that it's relative to, so we have to define what the temperature is in order to define what S is. And so in principle, we're still defining everything relative to the temperature. But I mean, these things are ultimately all interchangeable. But yeah, you're right. So we're basically out of time. So let me just write down the formula for the entropy density. It looks a lot like the formula for the energy density, except it scales like T cubed times this factor G star S, where G star S is the sum over bosons Ti over T cubed plus the sum over fermions Ti times 7/8 for relativistic only. And so what we find is that by measuring things relative to this entropy, we're already accounting for the expansion of the universe. And we'll see next time why that's useful to do. So if there are any questions, let me know. Otherwise, I'm around all day, so feel free to stop by if you have anything. OK, thanks.
Oh, it's a tutorial too.
Sorry, what are those subscripts on all of these sums?
So this is the sum over each species of boson
and each species of fermion. So for instance, if I have an electron and a quark, and then so this G is the number of spin states. So if I have a fermion that has spin up and spin down, that's a factor of two, essentially. So.
And sorry, why?
So the 7/8 comes from the fact that there's a relative plus and minus sign.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. It's the same thing as why there's a relative 1 3/4. So.